So I'm glad to be here today talking about things that interest me. And I'm glad that they interest you as well. There is so much new information with regards to strategies that may be useful to us as we begin a new year, as we want to optimize, as we want to, do the best that we can with what we've been given. And so as we look at the topic today of trimming down and shaping up in this new year, I'm reminded of a commercial that's on TV today, recently been on TV, where this question is addressed. How would I trim up or trim down and lose weight? If it was a drill instructor answering that question, what would you expect to hear? Maybe something like, well, get off the couch, you lazy idiot, and stop eating so much. Well, that wouldn't be very helpful, would it? Would that motivate you? Well, I just recently attended a graduation for the Marines just last Friday. My nephew was graduating right here in San Diego. And I wish I had a picture to show you. I just thought of it as I was driving here this afternoon. But I was able to meet Paul, my nephew's drill instructor, wonderful man. Shook his hand, thanked him for all the hard work he'd gone through in the last 12 weeks, where they're literally on 24/7. They're working hard to educate and encourage and get these recruits through the program so they can graduate. Well, I said to him, okay, why don't you, I want to get a picture of you posing, yelling at my nephew. And boy, it did take two questions. He immediately started yelling at him as I got a picture, a wonderful picture of him, of this drill instructor just letting my nephew Paul have it. And but when people who have all the answers start essentially getting on our case about things, are we very motivated to make a change? Well, if you're in the Marines, you are. But the rest of the world doesn't operate under that type of motivation. And most of us would get upset, offended, and give up under that type of pressure. So the real motivation here, the real question that we should be discussing today is, why do I feel like eating the things that I know are not good for me? That's a very practical question. Many times we're not aware of that. We're just concerned about, why is it that I am now gaining weight? Why is it that my muscles aren't as strong as they used to be? My shape continues to change in the wrong direction. Why is that? We're concerned about that, but we really need to ask a question, why do I feel the way I do? Why do I feel like eating the foods I know are not good for me? Today we're going to be talking about the things that drive our feelings. It is very difficult if we need to lose weight or we need to get into shape to just overpower through the sheer power of will. Overpower that feeling of wanting to sit on the couch, that feeling of wanting to eat those things that we know are not good for us. So we need to step back and start addressing the things that drive that feeling. And hopefully we'll get some good strategies for all of us that it will remind us what actually makes us feel better so we don't have to seek out unhealthy things to make us feel better. See, that's a sign of addiction, by the way. Did you know that we're all at risk of addiction? We all have different addictions that can challenge us. Some of us are better at dealing with them than others, but we all have them. They're all there. Sometimes hiding, sometimes waiting for that more stressful moment in your life. Maybe not right now, but maybe next month or 6 months from now, the cumulative stress gets to a certain threshold, and all of a sudden these addictions come right out of the closet. They could be all kinds of addictions. We're not just talking food addiction here. We're talking alcohol addiction, gambling addiction, sexual addictions, work addictions, hostility addictions, violence addiction. All these are really in the same realm. They just express themselves in different ways based on our history, based on where we've come from and where we are right now. So another question that we want to ask is, what is it that drives this process? Let me begin by telling you of an interesting study that was conducted at the University of Arizona not too long ago, where a group of physicians and researchers were evaluating what is it that actually stimulates the fitness hormone. Now, you might be wondering, maybe some of you physiologists or medical people, well, I'm not sure I've heard of the fitness hormone before. As we're growing up, during childhood and through adolescence, the body releases growth hormone. And we understand that growth hormone is what helps us as children grow taller. But once we're adults, what's the value of growth hormone? Is that the growth hormone that makes us grow sideways? No, it's actually the hormone that helps prevent unnecessary growth sideways. And so for us as adults, when we talk about growth hormone, we're really talking about fitness hormone. We're talking about a hormone when optimized, when it is encouraged by the right strategies, this hormone can be elevated to a level that stimulates the muscle metabolism. Now, that's a fancy way of saying it's going to increase the body's ability to burn calories that otherwise are going to end up where? The places you don't want those calories to be. So the researchers at the University of Arizona Medical Center, they were looking at different exercises that could influence growth hormone levels. What they found was that the traditional recommended exercise of getting 30 minutes of cardiovascular exercise, of just getting your heart rate up to a certain level, like brisk walking, jogging, swimming, bicycling, and so forth, as healthy as that is, and we're going to talk about it within the context of a comprehensive exercise program this afternoon, but as healthy as that is, that did not increase growth hormone nearly as much as another form of exercise that would be a powerful way to trim up and to lose weight if necessary. What they did is they asked individuals in this study to participate in a form of exercise that we call intermittent exercise. We've talked about it before, where you go from kind of just casual walking or casual exercise to more robust exercise, and then you do that back and forth. And we know from other studies that if you do that back and forth, higher intensity, lower intensity exercise, it actually stimulates the thyroid organ to stimulate more thyroid hormone naturally. And of course, thyroid hormone is directly related to our metabolism. And that enhances the ability to burn unnecessary calories or calories that otherwise would be stored as fat. But it's not just a question of weight. It's also a question of a hormone that is critical for skin health, a hormone that's critical for mental acuity, a hormone that's critical for healthy hair, for a healthy heart, for a healthy immune system. if your thyroid levels are a little bit off, your immune system isn't going to be as strong. The likelihood of a cancer, which we all get from week to week, we all get little buds of cancer developing. The difference is are we able, through a healthy immune system, to destroy that cancer before it takes hold and it gets large enough so now the immune system, even when it's healthier, can't fully address that by itself. So when we look at the strategies to improve our physical health, our metabolism, our weight, through thyroid optimization, we're really talking about strategies that do far more than just help us trim up, far more than help us lose weight if we need to. It cuts to the core of improved health and the ability to prevent the ravages and disabilities associated with premature disease and disability. So, as these researchers worked with these individuals, they discovered that if the participants engaged in 8 sets, remember these numbers, 8, 30, and 60. 8, 30, and 90. I was shortchanging you there for a second. 8 sets of 30 seconds of intense activity followed by 90 seconds of significant slowdown activity. You never stop. Keep the body moving. But you go from 30 seconds of intense, of hard exercise. Now, hard is a relative term. What might be very easy and light to an athlete could be excruciatingly hard for me. So as we talk about this general information on health, you always have to make sure that you're incorporating, you're integrating this information to what you already know about yourself. Clearly, if you haven't exercised for years and you're finally now motivated to start an exercise program, you want to start with light exercise. You want to let your body build up gradually. You never increase the intensity or the duration of an exercise more than 10% per week. That's the general rule. And so, but for those of us that have already been walking on a regular basis, brisk walking or some other type of activity, one of the most valuable things that we could do to improve our fitness level, to trim down, to improve our metabolism, is to follow what many wellness doctors are now calling peak exercise, peak fitness type strategies, where you do 8 sets of 30 seconds of intense exercise followed by 90 seconds of slowdown. For instance, you get on your stationary exercise bike at home or in the gym. You warm up for 4 to 5 minutes to make sure your muscles are warmed up and you're not going to pull any muscles, because that's the last thing we want to do is get injured, right? You're motivated, you know, new year, and we're going to do something great this year, and then you lose moderation. You lose the idea of prudence. You get in there and work out too hard, and within a week, you're worn out and injured, and it'll take another year before you regain the passion to think about getting into an exercise program. So the worst thing that can happen is start out too fast, too hard. Okay, so I'm cautioning us about that. But within that context, if we find what is reasonable and prudent for us right now, once we're warmed up and the muscles are flexible, if you're on a stationary bike, start just pedaling faster. Where you're starting to get out of breath, okay, and you're feeling that anaerobic threshold has been passed. You're no longer able to continue that exercise for 5, 6, 10 minutes. You're getting out of breath in just a few 10 to 15 seconds. You continue that for about 30 seconds, and then you slow way down. You keep moving the legs. Now, why not just stop? Why keep moving your legs? Because the muscles are an important adjunct to the heart. The heart is pounding furiously during that 30-second intensive exercise. The muscles are helping pump the blood back up to the heart so the heart can pump it back down to the muscle and to the brain. If you just stop moving for 90 seconds, now the heart has to do all the work. The heart doesn't like that. The heart's supposed to be resting too during that 90 seconds. And so continuing to move your legs, to move the body during that 90-second resting phase, it's not a true rest, it's just a slowdown phase, is very important. And then after that 90 seconds is over, what do we do now? Hit the showers? No, we got how many more sets? Seven more sets. So it's a total of eight sets, eight repetitions, where we go 30 warm up and then 30 seconds intense, 90 seconds slow down, back and forth, eight times total. Now, how many minutes have we just exercised? Okay. We have been involved in some type of activity for 20 minutes. But how many minutes have we actually exercised? 4 minutes. Okay, now, we've all seen those commercials, right? 5 minutes a day, and you can get fit and trim. Well, we have a new study that suggests that 4 minutes three times a week can get you fit and trim. Okay, but there's a trick to it. You also have to do those other 16 minutes for that to work. Okay, so just think about it. Psychologically, isn't that somewhat encouraging? Wow, I could do this workout with eight sets of 30 seconds intensity, and in 4 minutes, 2 to 3 times a week, I can dramatically improve my fitness. Now, here's the real interesting part of this. As the researchers were looking at how this influenced the fitness hormone, they found that that activity could increase the growth hormone, the fitness hormone, up to 500%. Now, there's individuals out there, athletes, bodybuilders, people that are looking for shortcuts in the sports field, we call it ergogenic aids. Things that help boost your performance that may be appropriate, but many of them are not appropriate. Many of them are illegal. And individuals are paying thousands of dollars a month to inject growth hormone because it trims them down and it makes them look muscular and lean. And it makes them look like what the exercise physiologists refer to as the sprinter body type. Have you ever watched the track and field events? When it comes to the sprinter, who looks fitter, the sprinter or the marathon runner? The sprinter. The marathon runners are very lean and very skinny and they have very long, smooth muscles, but pretty smooth. Whereas the sprinter is ripped. The sprinter is all these muscles that you can tell they're there. You can tell that he's strong, that he's vigorous. And that is the concept behind if you do these short sprints followed by rest phase and short sprints followed by rest phase, it actually stimulates this growth hormone in a similar way as somebody who's injecting growth hormone. The difference is it's totally natural. It's not illegal. And it's good for you. You're getting all the benefits without the negative risk. Other studies have suggested even if we did that once a week, it would benefit us. The Arizona studies were looking at three times a week, interspersed with other forms of activity. So let's look at what a comprehensive exercise program might look like for somebody who's really motivated that wants to use exercise to get the most wellness potential. So the first step is to make sure that we are active, that we have aerobic activity in our regular week. And normally we would be saying about 3 times a week, you're involved in at least a 30-minute, preferably a 45-minute, sustained aerobic activity where you're, you know, you're breathing heavy, but you're able to sustain that for 30 to 45 minutes. It's not so high like this peak performance exercise where you're out of breath and you literally have to stop and catch your breath for 90 seconds. It's just sustained. You can do it. You're sweating. And of course, sweating removes toxins from your body. It makes you feel better. It's a great way to decrease the stress, the chemical stress on the body, releasing that through the sweat. So 3 times a week, cardiovascular exercise, brisk walking, jogging, bicycling, swimming, stationary bicycles. Those would be great examples of that. Hiking, climbing the foothills of the mountains in this area. Wonderful activity. Then we have the 8 sets, the peak performance type exercise where we're prudently, moderately building the body's ability to become stronger. And the benefit comes from that growth fitness hormone. The other form of exercise might be a more specific body toning type activity, which would be more typically a weightlifting routine or using machines at the gym or doing calisthenics at home, push-ups, sit-ups, pull-ups. My son, who's 17, he's challenging me. He has challenged me and surpassed me. And, of course, every father wants to see their son surpass. I hope every father wants that. And just last week, he said, "Dad, come watch this." So he works out every night before he goes to bed. And he did 18 pull-ups. And he's a big guy. He's a lot bigger and stronger than I am. And so he had to pull up a lot more weight than I would. And I was proud of him. Wow, 18 pull-ups. And so what is it then that benefits us the most in terms of trimming up? It's making sure that we first do the right exercise. 8 sets of 30 seconds followed by 90-second rest. And then here's the key. If we then after that exercise go, "Whoa, I'm famished," and we go grab a soda, guess what? The growth hormone, fitness hormone enhancing effect of that exercise was just eliminated. It was just neutralized. If we go and eat a starchy meal, if we go and eat anything that causes the blood sugars to spike, however temporarily, that would eliminate a large portion of that fitness building, body toning, muscle toning effect. And what the researchers at the University of Arizona discovered was that when the blood sugars spike, even if it's only for 20 minutes, see, most people who check their blood sugars, whether they're pre-diabetic or diabetic, check it 2 hours after the beginning of a meal, if they're diabetic. If they're pre-diabetic, they may occasionally check 1 hour after the beginning of the meal. But even if your blood sugar just spikes at 20 to 30 minutes and then it's already down at 1 hour, that spike has already initiated an excessive release of insulin by the pancreas. And that extra surge of insulin that now is flooding the bloodstream negates, it interacts with other hormones to shut down the powerful growth hormone, fitness-enhancing effects that we're looking for. So there's many people who do the exercise right, but they don't understand that there's consequences associated with what we eat and when we eat it. So there is, there are some tests that I frequently recommend to individuals who come to see me that I have found to be extremely beneficial in helping them understand, how do I improve my health? Not just how do I get fitter, more importantly, how do I lower my risk of the diseases that are ravaging our country today? It's estimated that within the next 10 years, 50% of adults in America will have either prediabetes or diabetes. It's already 40%. We're already, in a serious way, experiencing a lot of problems. But most people with prediabetes, I estimate that 90% of individuals with prediabetes have no idea. They're completely unaware of the risk that is occurring within their body at the present time. And one of the reasons they're unaware is because every year when they have their physical, which should occur, they look at that fasting blood glucose, the fasting blood sugar, and it looks like it's in the perfect range. And it actually many times is in the perfect range. They don't realize that the majority of people with prediabetes have normal fasting pre-meal blood sugars, but their blood sugars after a meal, especially after a starchy meal or a sugary meal, that is what tells us what the risk really is. And so that's why I frequently encourage individuals to get a glucose tolerance test. That's either a 2-hour or a 4-hour test where you have your blood sugar and other and insulin levels and other tests done before the sugar drink, and then the lab tech gives you 75 grams of glucose, which is not an unusual amount of glucose to consume in a meal. And then the sugar and the insulin levels are checked again throughout the test to see where are the spikes, where are the drop-offs, how does this affect insulin, how does this affect the adrenal stress hormones in the body. It becomes a real functional endocrine test to see what's going on in the body. Because up to 80% of all cardiovascular disease is actually caused by insulin resistance, doesn't it make sense that we need to concentrate more of our evaluation on insulin resistance? There is a love affair in modern medicine with cholesterol. I check it too. I think it's an important test to check. But in my opinion, it's nowhere near as important as evaluating how the body controls blood sugar and how much insulin your body produces. Those are simple tests to run. So if 80% of our risk for cardiovascular disease is caused by insulin resistance, then cholesterol by itself can't be more than 20%, right? And so we should maybe emphasize cholesterol about 20% and emphasize the metabolic syndrome about 80%. It's the metabolic syndrome, it's the insulin fluctuations, the blood sugar fluctuations that are the primary drivers of triglyceride blood fats, primary drivers of high blood pressure. Individuals who have high blood pressure, it's more than likely, again, up to 80% of the time, if the blood pressure is high, that's usually because of an insulin resistant scenario. And those things can be evaluated accurately doing the glucose tolerance testing. It's not in vogue, by the way. You might discuss it with a physician who's a good physician, but they might look at you and say, well, you know, that's not how I practice. And that's why the specialty of lifestyle medicine and nutritional medicine is more in tune with that approach of evaluating our health. So because it's so likely that most of us have at least something to gain by improving our blood sugar levels, our insulin levels, and our metabolism, what are some things that we can start doing right now? What are some strategies that would be useful for you and I to participate in a daily basis. The first thing to be aware of is to, well, let me tell you a story first. I had a 17-year-old young lady came in to see me with her mother and father. They were very concerned. She was a star volleyball player. And they had been at a competition in another state. And while in the hotel room, she had started getting dizzy, threw up, and blacked out. Any parent would be scared to death. They called 911. Ambulance came, rushed her to the emergency room in that city's, the closest hospital in that city. The emergency room physicians were very alarmed. Here's this extremely fit 17-year-old athlete who is collapsing, and they can't figure out what's wrong. They keep her in the hospital for 3 days. They run thousands, tens of thousands of dollars worth of tests, and they can't find one thing wrong with her. They brought her back. She was feeling fine after the first day, but she was concerned. The parents were scared and perplexed. So they brought her in to see her primary care physician. And so one day, I received a call from their physician saying, hey, just went over the case with me. And so I said, you know, let's just run a 4-hour glucose tolerance test on her. But because we didn't want to wait to get the results back 3 or 4 days later to do something, I suggested that on the way home, they'd stop at the pharmacy and they get a little testing kit, which they can get for $20, $30. And get some strips and have her start checking her blood sugars to see if there was something going on during the day that caused blood sugars to drop, and that seemed to be a likely scenario in her case. This was on a Friday. The next morning, Saturday morning, she wakes up, and so she'd been through a lot of stress during the previous week, but she wakes up at home, and she feels like she's coming down with the flu. She's got a bad headache. She feels horrible. But being one of these high-achiever seniors, you know, great athletes, she just knew what she had to do. So she got up, and she got the kit out and had never used it before and poked her finger and let a little bit of that blood absorb into the strip, and she waited for the number, and no number showed up. And, you know, so she, well, I must have done this wrong. So she did it again, and it basically said low. And so she goes to see her mom and says, well, honey, you need to eat something. So she did something that she didn't usually do. She ate breakfast. And lo and behold, about 30 minutes later, her flu symptoms were gone. Her headache was rapidly dissipating. She was getting her energy back. The tunnel vision that she had experienced was dissipating as well. And then she checked her blood sugar. Good for her. Okay, because we don't know unless we test. We have to be objective in life. So she'd had two readings that were either undetectable or read low, and now she checked and her blood sugars were 84, which is actually what it should be before a meal, not after a meal. Okay, but at least it was now at a level that the brain could start to function. She brought that. She came in to see me a few days later, and so I said, well, what does your kit say about low? So she says, well, I have it right here. And she looked at the instructions, and she'd never read the instructions. Sounds like me. And then she looked at the instructions and said, oh, it says here, if it says low, the reading is less than 20. Now, if you've had any experience with blood sugars, 20 is an extremely low. Anything under 70 is low. Anything under 60 is definitely low. Anything under 50 is becoming more, is creating complications. Anything under 30 is starting to destroy brain cells. And under 20, you're like one step away from coma. The question is, why was this fit 17-year-old athlete experiencing low blood sugar levels? Her liver, our liver has the capacity to store 3 pounds of sugar. It's rarely devoid of sugar. The liver has lots of sugar. So the problem in this case was is that the hormones responsible for telling the liver to release a little bit of sugar so that the brain can be more functional, so that the other organ systems can work more functionally, that was no longer being communicated. Those hormones weren't working properly. Why was it that the adrenal hormones responsible for telling the liver, keep releasing sugar, why was it that those hormones were not being released? I'd like to suggest to you that if we live a life or we lead an existence that is constantly under stress, that is constantly pushing the boundaries, is constantly moving on to the next thing. And while we recognize that we should be doing this, we should be going to bed, we should be getting a little exercise, we should take the time to experience and enjoy family, we're just moving on to the next thing. We got things to do, places to go. And if we keep living that way, what happens is we develop a hormonal imbalance. Not just one hormone is out of balance. All the hormones get out of balance. And that causes premature aging. Now, a 17-year-old young lady might not typically notice that, at least not initially. But you'll be able to tell a difference in the years to come, just on physical and emotional and other health characteristics. So as I talked with her that first day, I asked her a lot of questions. I said, just tell me, just what do you typically eat for breakfast, lunch, and dinner? So, oh, no, I never eat breakfast. I don't have time. I'm a senior honor student, and I got class at 7 in the morning, and I get up, and I practice volleyball for 4 hours a day, and I don't have time for stuff like that. And so I said, can I give you a little lecture? And we had a good relationship. And I said, if you don't start eating breakfast, you're not going to be a good volleyball player. You're not going to be able to do the things that you want to do. Okay? You cannot continue to live that way. So we got her into eating 3 solid meals, healthy, balanced meals a day. We got her on some medicinal foods, glycemic foundation shakes for breakfast and before and after workouts. And you know what? Her coaches at school said, would you give a pep talks to the other teams, the soccer team, to the basketball team? Because said, we know what happened to you. We know that, you know, she was the best setter on the whole team but could not function. She was going to have to quit her sports because of her physical health. But now, because she's just learned how to balance her blood sugars through timing of meals, through balancing of meals, she is now has the best endurance of all the athletes in the school. So the coaches have her giving lectures to all the other teams of how to achieve peak performance, peak fitness. So always eat breakfast. Now, you may not feel like eating breakfast, okay? Right? Okay, but becoming healthy isn't about following how you feel, is it? Right? If we followed what we felt like doing, we would be in trouble 24 hours a day. We'd be in trouble with our spouse. We'd be in trouble with our parents. We'd be in trouble with our children. We'd be in trouble with our bosses, with our teachers, with the law, with everybody. Right? Okay? I think we recognize that one of the most important attributes of living a healthy, happy life is learning how to effectively set limits on ourselves. We cannot be happy unless we set limits on ourselves. That's guaranteed. That's not philosophy. That is guaranteed. If we cannot learn to set limits in every aspect of our lives, we will be the most miserable, unhealthy people alive. So understand that. And one of the limits that this young lady had to set on herself was, when I get up in the morning and I don't feel like eating, I just feel like going to my 7 o'clock morning class, says, I'm going to stop and eat breakfast because I know it's good for me. Because I know if I don't do that, I may collapse during volleyball practice at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. She learned that through education and through experience. The next strategy that is so critical is that how likely am I to follow a fitness program where I am exercising in this growth hormone enhancing way if I really, really, really don't feel like exercising today? Have you ever felt like that? I mean, yeah, I've felt that. I'm sure we've all felt that way many times. We just don't feel like doing it. Now, remember, one of the greatest attribute that brings health and success in all walks of life is if we develop a plan at a time in our day or our week where we're being objective, where we're being prudent, where we're being moderate. We understand all the factors that come together as we plan out our week. And during that salient 30 minutes of developing our plan, we come up with something that is reasonable that we should be able to do that week. And then the rest of the week, when we get to a point and it's time to do something, and the initial thought is, do I really have time to do that? Do I really feel like doing that? Those thoughts are sabotaging what we know to be a prudent, effective, moderate, healthy plan. So we need to immediately stop that type of thinking and just do what we know is the right thing to do at that time. So we need to follow our plan, not follow our feelings. But see, if we really, really, really don't feel like doing it, what's going to happen? We might be able to overpower that feeling for a while. But how many of us, let's be honest, how many of us are really that effective at overpowering that feeling long term? I know I'm not. I haven't seen too many people that can do that. I remember a patient I had in Sun City about 20 years ago. And he was concerned about his heart and his blood sugars. And so I was kind of apologizing to him because I was going over some nutritional variable. And I knew that it wasn't part of his current lifestyle. He was a crotchety old farmer. And he came in with his raspy voice. And I know he had been standing outside smoking a cigar for half hour before he came in to meet with me. And so I was kind of apologizing to him. I know this is probably not what you were expecting. And he said, "Doctors, give it to me straight." He said, "If you tell me I need to eat barbed wire, I'm going to eat barbed wire." So a few of us can do stuff like that. But let's face it, most of us get overwhelmed by how we feel, right? So what is it that so powerfully creates those feelings? And I think one of the most important things, in fact, if I had to pick one thing from the physical world, from the natural world, that would be the most important thing for you to take away today to improve your metabolism, to improve your potential to actually follow a fitness strategy, to follow a healthy diet, to actually actually start feeling like eating breakfast is to pay attention to your sleep pattern. And, you know, a lot of people have no clue. They just think, hey, you know, I'm so lucky I can stay up to 1 o'clock in the morning, and then I wake up at 6:30, 7, and I get the job done. I get all this extra work done, and, that's the only way I'm able to get this stuff done, if I stay up late when after the kids have gone to bed, and I finally have some time to think and process, and I get all that work done. But guess what we've just done? We have sabotaged our ability to feel like doing the things that we know are good for us. It's probably the most powerful way to sabotage our ability to feel like doing the things that are good for us. So why is that? How can that be? And I know some of you are a little incredulous over this. Like, are you kidding me? I don't get that at all. And you'll be tempted to walk away and, you know, and I don't blame you. You need to understand the mechanisms. But there's a lot of research on this. Get online and Google this. It's more than I can read. There's a tremendous amount of research on this. And essentially, what has happened is that prior to Thomas Edison bringing us the incandescent light bulb, what happened when the sun set? Well, you know, if you're Abraham Lincoln, you stayed up reading by the fire, light a candle for a while, but how long would that last? You know, they might do that for one or two or, if they're really, really splurging, 3 hours. And so nowadays, if we splurged and we stayed up for 3 hours after sundown, what time would we be going to bed? Have you ever thought of it that way? That seems so awfully early, doesn't it? Well, there was a middle-aged man who had horrible insomnia. Nothing that his doctor prescribed to him, nothing that he did seemed to overcome his problem with insomnia. He had problems getting to sleep. He had problems staying asleep. It was just miserable. And so he decided he was going to do his own research because all his doctors hadn't been able to solve his problem. And so he started doing his research, and he discovered that any exposure to light after the sun naturally sets in the western horizon has a potential to influence our ability to sleep. Did you hear my emphasis? Okay, has the potential. So, if you are among those individuals that have a hard time with sleep, consider this following this type of strategy. What this middle-aged man did is that he had read that especially the blue light, it actually mimics sunlight to a degree, and so that light goes through your retina to your pineal gland, and it actually shuts down the ability to produce melatonin. So melatonin would normally, the hormone that is the fix-it and then rejuvenate hormone that restores our health, that brings healing during the nighttime hours to the body, the mind, that hormone starts to be increased in production around 9 o'clock typically. But it requires perfect darkness to optimize that production. And so as he researched this, he decided that he was going to, at sundown, turn off every light in his house. He even turned off the light bulb inside of the refrigerator. I don't know if that meant that he was planning to have a snack. I don't know. But so around 6 o'clock, he just turned everything off. The LED light on the clock radio. No lights were on in the whole house. And he found that as a horrible insomniac, that he would hit the pillow about 9 o'clock and sleep 8 to 9 hours. And it was such a profound impact on his health that he said this, and I quote, "I had the experience a number of times just feeling kind of unreasonably happy for no reason whatsoever. It was the sleep." He says, sure, you can get by with 6 or 7 hours, but sleeping 8 or 9 hours created a different state of mind. When was the last time that you felt unreasonably happy? When's the last time that we were just overjoyed to be alive? We didn't get any special gift, or, you know, there was nothing special that happened. It's just like, we're just like, oh, this is great. I'm alive. I'm enjoying life so much. Could it be that God wants us to feel that way? But the choices that we make sabotage the potential, that God-given gift in us that allows us to experience joy? I've experienced in my life that if I don't pay attention to this natural law of the circadian rhythms of life, is that I feel unreasonably grumpy. Have any of you felt unreasonably grumpy? Do any of you live with somebody that you feel is unreasonably grumpy? Could it be possibly that it actually is due to not being in tune with these natural laws, these principles, that if properly understood, would give us the potential to improve our health immeasurably? Now, some of you might be thinking, well, wait a minute, what does it have to do with trimming down and losing weight in the new year? Okay? It has everything to do. In fact, I would say that if you only did one thing to accomplish trimming down and shaping up in this new year, is commit yourself to getting to bed by 10 o'clock and getting up by 6, or something similar. Everybody has a little bit different rhythm, okay? But commit yourself to going to bed at a time that we know, based on physiologic principles, based on studies that have been repeated over and over, that your melatonin, that hormone, that neurotransmitter that relates to healing potential, healing the neurologic stresses that we go through, healing the physical stresses that we've experienced, healing us because of the toxins that we've been exposed to in this toxic and sin-sick world on a daily basis, healing us from all the things going on around us. If we don't take advantage of that healing from that nighttime rhythm of melatonin, then should there be any wonder that we're not well? Should there be any wonder that we're fighting the ravages of all kinds of diseases that are affecting us prematurely? I've heard, I remember a few, about 10 years ago, back in Guam, I was in the waiting room of the clinic, and a nurse asked me to talk to a patient that wasn't actually coming in to see me. He was coming in to see one of the internists, and he had heard me talk before, and he had a question about some medications he was taking for diabetes. And he'd heard my talk about insulin resistance, and he says, don't talk to me about that. He says, that's what the medicine is for. Says, my blood sugars are high, and I'm taking medicine. I'm doing what I need to do. The medicine brings my blood sugars under control. Does the medication bring the blood sugar under better control? No question. Okay, that's it's been studied. We know that if you take these medications appropriately, they will lower your blood sugars. But who said that lowering your blood sugars in of it itself would solve any problems? Oh, he had never thought of that. See, sometimes we have this notion that, okay, I got high blood pressure, so I'm taking 2, 3, 4 medications for high blood pressure, and my blood pressure is most of the time well-regulated. Well, who says that by controlling blood pressure, that in of itself is actually going to lead to wellness or significantly improved health? It will lower a risk. But that's very similar to having a fence on the edge of a precipice that's tattered and worn and dangerous, and you repair about a 20-foot section of it, leaving 150 feet of fence where anybody could lean against it and fall 100 feet to their death. See, that's the problem with just relegating our health. It's just taking medicines. It's not that there's something inherently bad with the medicine. Medicine can be very helpful, okay? But the medication in of itself isn't addressing the cause of the problem. So what we need to try to understand is where's this coming from? And so if these brilliant professors out of Stanford and Duke University who have done this mathematical model called the Archimedes model, determining that 80% of the risk of cardiovascular disease comes from insulin resistance, not from cholesterol per se, we shouldn't feel comfortable. We shouldn't be lured into a false sense of security just because our cholesterol is now being managed effectively with a statin. That's not enough. We need to look at the bigger issues. We need to integrate them. We need to work with our physicians to be on the right medicines. And I tell you, there's a lot of physicians out there that are sick of giving you all those medications, or giving us all those medications. They long to help get you to the point where you don't need those. But how's that going to happen if we don't get to the core causes of this problem? And so, if we are not taking the time to sleep at the right time, what happens is that how likely are we to feel like eating breakfast, feel like getting that exercise, because we are just kind of running on empty. And when we're running on empty, we are drawn to what? Instead of a healthy breakfast, we're drawn to a cup of coffee and a Danish. Okay, instead of a healthy salad or soup for lunch, we're drawn to an In-N-Out burger and French fries. Right, because that's what gives us an initial surge of energy that makes us feel alive again, and so we're drawn to these shortcuts that lead to greater disease and greater disability. So I urge you to consider sleep as one of the most important decisions that you can make. Getting to bed early. Getting up early. And then we have exposure to sunlight. We mentioned that in order to get optimal melatonin production at night, we need to get to bed roughly by 10 o'clock. We know that for every hour of sleep before midnight, we get twice as much melatonin compared for every hour of sleep after midnight. So the idea of like, well, I went to bed at midnight, but I got up at 9, so I got 8 or 9 hours of sleep, so I'm good, right? No, it's not good. It doesn't work that way. It's not just the amount of time, it's timing. It's when we do it relative to the natural circadian rhythm of our locale, relative to when the sun sets and when the sun rises. That's what we need to be in tune with. So, but in order to actually optimize that production, we first have to be exposed to natural light. I was commenting to my wife just this week. She says, I've been going in to work before the sun rises and coming home after the sun sets. Unfortunately, far too late after the sun sets. And I realized I wasn't getting any sun. I wasn't getting exposed to any natural light. And you know what the consequence was? Feeling tired, foggy thinking, just feeling more stressed, more anxious, even though I didn't think I should feel that way. And, you know, some of us are really stubborn. You know, we just keep doing the same thing over and over again, even though it's not working. And we don't stop to evaluate what's causing this problem. And I realized, wow, you know, I talk about this all the time, but I wasn't doing it myself. Have you ever done that? I realized that I wasn't getting at least 30 minutes of natural sunlight a day. And let me suggest to you that that's critical, because unless you get 30 minutes of natural sunlight a day, you're not going to produce optimal melatonin at night when it's dark. Okay? There's a rhythm that we need to experience. Now, I'm not saying you need to be out in the middle of the day and burn yourself for 30 minutes. You didn't hear me say that. Okay? I'm saying outside for 30 minutes in bright light. That can happen at 7 in the morning. That can happen at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I would spend some of that time midday, even if it's only a few minutes, because midday is going to give you what? Vitamin D. And that has powerful factors influencing the nervous system, influencing the mood, influencing our immune system, influencing our metabolism, influencing our ability to hormonally regulate fat, to our ability to burn fat. Okay, so don't be cinchy on vitamin D. So take the time to be outside. So we've gone over time, and we've gone over multiple strategies. Let me encourage you to don't just push your way through a wellness program. Don't just use stamina and willpower and I'm going to do this if it kills me attitude, because that type of stress actually could kill us over time. Don't follow a wellness program so rigorously that it actually causes more stress and more damage to your body than not doing anything at all. Follow a program prudently by understanding how the body works, by understanding this awesome creation that we have been entrusted with, and then developing a plan once a week, for about 30 minutes, just taking some time to evaluate your week and say, hey, how'd I do? It reminds me of what God did on that final day of the week of creation. He's after that crowning work of creation, his creation of man and woman, what did he do? He rested and He spent time with his creation, okay, and he contemplated what he had accomplished, and he said what? It is good. He took the time to experience it, to enjoy it, and that's what we need to do as well. If we evaluate that and say, okay, how did I do? And we can find the areas of our lives in the past week that, you know, maybe didn't reach our potential, and we don't have to feel guilty about that. We just need to acknowledge it and then move on. Say, now what am I going to do this next week that is going to help me reach the next level? Okay? Then I follow the number one most important strategy. I can tell how I'm doing in every other area of my life based on whether I'm getting to bed around 10 o'clock every night. If I get to bed at 10 o'clock consistently over a week, I know that every other aspect of my life is going to be better. Why? Because now I have this unreasonable sense of happiness and joy that drives me, that encourages me to do all the things I know are right and I know are good for me. Isn't that how we want to live our lives? Just having all this energy to do what is best, to do what is right, to do what is noble. So I hope that you join me in that resolution for this new year, to do what is best. Thank you, and I look forward to seeing you at dinner with the doctor. You want to announce it?
To just come up and share with us the instructions that we need to hear.
We hope that you're all planning on joining us for dinner. We have lots of healthy options and plenty of food for everybody. So even if you didn't RSVP, we want you to feel welcome. We're just going to ask you to exit out of the back and out of that door right there. And go and take a seat in the fellowship hall. We're going to have a cooking demo before the meal, so just wait to get food and just take a seat, and we'll try to get in there as quickly as possible. The faster we get done, the faster we can eat, but not too much.
And get to bed early.